Colossians 3:5-3:6. The 10th talk in a series on Colossians was presented by Ron Julian on September 19, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay, well, good morning. We're in Colossians again. I want to talk to you a minute here before we get started. Around here, we put a lot of emphasis on exegesis, on interpretation of the Bible. We kick around a lot of ideas like context and the flow of thought and this is what the word meant in the Greek and all of that sort of thing. And I know that, I mean, even for those of us who are really into all of that, there are times when that can seem like somewhat of an abstract exercise. It doesn't seem like the meaning of Greek words is the thing that is foremost on my mind when I'm dealing with, you know, a daughter that has polyps in her throat or something like that. It seems very far removed from the place where life is hitting me the hardest. But I'm convinced the reason I spend a lot of my time thinking about those kinds of things is that what we ought to be interested in, if we take the Bible seriously, we ought to be interested in what it is that the biblical authors were actually trying to say. This has been one of the drums that we have been beating around here for a long time. It matters. We will get involved in a huge battle over whether the Bible is inerrant or not, but in the end, it doesn't really matter in practical terms whether I think the Bible is inerrant if I am so careless in the way that I read it that I am in error in everything I read. I'm reading a book without errors and getting it all wrong. There's, in the end, I've come down to the same place. So I ought to care, first of all, about what it is that the Bible is actually saying, and that means then being willing to be patient at times and to just sit back and try to sort out what is it that Paul's talking about. Now, one of the reasons that I'm saying this here is because we're about to come across a little section in Colossians, which in my mind is of a certain genre of passage. They're important kinds of passages to me because in my history, this may not be true for any of you here, and you know, I may be exploring an issue that is absolutely not even an issue for the folks that are here. But for me, this has been one of the big issues of my faith. I come from a group of folks who had a certain way of looking at the Bible and had a certain theological emphasis that I'll talk about here in a minute that I have come to believe since was mistaken. It wasn't true. It was a misreading of a number of passages, and the passage we're going to look at today is one of those kinds of passages that would tend to get misread. In my journey as a Christian, it made a lot of difference that I was hearing something that I think ultimately was not true in the formative years of my faith. It gave me something to really wrestle with. So let me give you an example. Suppose now, I don't know how many of you are letter writers, but suppose in the distant future, years after your death, there is a cult religion that grows up around you. You are the founder of a new religion. You don't even know that you're founding this religion, but they've come across your letters and recognized the wisdom, the profound wisdom of everything that you wrote, and so this religion grows up around you. and they read all of your letters as scriptures. Okay. So in one of your letters, you say something. You say, you're writing to a friend, you're kind of worried about where this friend is at, and you say something like, I really would like to urge you to think twice about that. Okay, so your followers in the distant future, they read this, I urge you to think twice. Ah, that's the key. Our founder has told us the key to finding peace, fulfillment, and happiness in this life. You have to think twice. And so this discipline develops where everyone tries to consciously make it so that every time a thought comes into their head, they think it again. That's the key to fulfillment. Aha, I think I'll get a cup of coffee. Wait, I think I'll get a cup of coffee. Now it'll work. Now the blessing is going to come. Well, do you see what's happened in that situation? Is that what you meant? When you said, I really would urge you to think twice, did you mean to found a set of religious disciplines that are the key to fulfillment in life? No. There was something else that you meant. It was an expression you were using. It did have something to do with thinking twice, but it was a more, in a sense, a more mundane but more profound exhortation. I want you to reconsider the foolish way you have been thinking and think about it again and come to a different conclusion. That's what you meant. Okay, well, what can happen as we come to the Bible and read it is if we get too stubborn, too insistent, too unwilling to let the biblical authors set their own agenda and tell us what it is that they have on their minds, then we can come with our questions and take various statements and turn them into something that they're not intended to be. I'm looking for the answer to this question. And I go to passages, whether they're talking about that question or not, I'm going to use them to give me the answer to the questions that I have. Now let me read you the section that we're looking at today. We're in chapter 3 of Colossians, with verse 5, I believe. Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. For it is on account of these things that the wrath of God will come, and in them you also once walked when you were living in them. But now you also put them all aside. Anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive speech from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices, and you have put on the new self, who is being renewed to a true knowledge according to the image of the one who created him. A renewal in which there is no distinction between Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave and free man, but Christ is all and in all. Okay, well, in my background, a passage like this, people would come at it something like this. This is a letter written to Christians. So we know that the issue isn't salvation. He's not urging them to believe the gospel and be saved, because we know they already believe the gospel and that's a settled issue. This must be about some further issue. Okay, you're saved, you believe in Jesus, you're going to heaven, but you're missing something. And now Paul is urging them to embrace this missing something that they don't have yet. What could that missing something be? Well, what is it as I look around, what is it that we need as Christians? We need power. We need to find the power to conquer ourselves. We need to find the power to have victory over sin, and so on. So that's what Paul's getting at in a passage like this, the thinking would go. When it says, consider the members of your earthly body as dead, that's the key to finding the victory over the sins that he's describing. You may be saved, you may believe in Jesus, you may be on your way to heaven, But the problem is you haven't been considering your earthly members as dead. And because you haven't been doing that, you haven't found the victory over sin. But now, if you will consider your earthly members as dead, that's the way to tap in to the reality that God has for you out there, and you'll find the power. Put on the new man, he says here. That's another way of describing the same thing. There is this power. There's the old man and the new man. And the new man is this new principle of victory that is living within you. And if you will put on that new man, then you will find the victory over sin that you have been missing. So I hope that's clear, the kind of perspective that I'm talking about. Maybe, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I read other people's situation out of my own. I don't know how many of you have run into that kind of thinking. Maybe only some of you, I don't know. But that's where I started, with that kind of teaching. And as some of you know, for a lot of reasons, and in a lot of ways, that teaching is largely responsible for me being a teacher now, because I couldn't make it work. I couldn't make sense out of what it was talking about. And so I started to look at the Bible for myself, sort of out of desperation, sort of, wait a minute, something isn't adding up here. This is not working. Well, so I am not an impartial person when I come to this question. It's a big issue for me. But the fact is, as I look at this passage, it seems to me that that way of thinking about it is imposing something on the text that's not there. This is not what it's talking about. This is not the issue. What I've been trying to do as we go along through Colossians is to show the nature of the issue that Paul is dealing with. And so the nature of his exhortation. Because that's what we want to know in the end, right? I mean, you and I want to know. I mean, maybe we don't want to know, but you ought to want to know. What is it that Paul has on his mind? What does he want from these Colossians? And so, ultimately, what does he want from me? If Paul could stand here instead of me, and I wish that were true just as much as you do, if he could stand here and expound to us the message that he was trying to get across to the Colossians, and he could answer our questions and elucidate for us, explain to us further, Paul, what is it, you know, what's the bottom line here? What do you want? What is it you're trying to get across to them? What would he say? What would that bottom line look like? Well, he's not here, so what we're trying to do is read carefully and find, what is it that he would say to us if he were trying to make this message come across to us now? So there are some things I think we need to keep in mind. What we have been seeing as we go along, that Paul is writing to people who may be on the verge of abandoning the faith altogether. On the one hand, he's encouraged that he sees signs of real faith among the Colossians, and yet there is this teaching that in modern times has been labeled the Colossian heresy that is growing up among them, and he's afraid that they're listening to it. And as we've seen, he's been warning them that they need to continue in the faith that they first embraced. If they walk away from Christ, they're getting nothing, because everything is found in Christ. That's what he's been saying. You're not going to find anything. You walk away from the gospel and you get nothing. You embrace the gospel and you have everything. That's what he's been trying to get across to them over and over. The Colossians are listening to teachers who are calling them to a legalistic, ascetic sort of religious life. Don't eat this. Don't drink this. Keep these festivals. Keep these Sabbaths and so on. You want to be a spiritual person? Show it by the rigor of the way you deny your body. Don't eat these things. Don't drink these things. Keep your life very ascetic and rigorous, and that's how you will show that you are a spiritual person. Paul sees this as a choice for a group of ascetic religious practices against the gospel. They have this choice to make. don't turn away from where real life is to be found to this false, ultimately worldly alternative, he's saying, because it is worldly. That's what we've been trying to get across as we go through this. So Paul is not teaching them how, this is not a letter to Christians teaching them how to find power over sin. This is a letter to people who are facing the choice, am I going to continue in the faith or not? And he's showing them how continuing in the faith is going to look in real life. Here are the choices you face. If the gospel is true, then you are going to believe these things. And because you believe these things, and because you embrace these values, then you're going to follow this path. That's the kind of letter that this is. So let me see if I can explain to you a little more what I see is going on here, what I mean by that, what he's really getting across here. As I said, there are these kind of two conflicting models of reality that he's trying to argue for one over against the other. The Colossian heresy has to do with this restriction, the eat these things, drink these things, and so on. Paul calls this set of religious rituals worldly. Even though it purports to be about God, in essence, it's really focused on this world. What can I get from a religious life in this world? Let me focus on how the things I eat and the things I drink and the festivals I keep. There is something about a certain ritualistic approach to religion that although it's theoretically about God, it's really about me now, here, in this world. The food I've got now and the drink I've got now or don't have now. That feeling of superiority I can gain because I don't eat and drink those things, and I'm watching you eat and drink them, and I can think, oh, you just don't have a clue. All of that, in essence, is about this world, Paul is saying, and we've been trying to flesh out a little bit. Why? What does he mean by that? It creates a superficial change in the way I deal with earthly things like food and drink, but it represents no real challenge to the worldly set of values that I have. It doesn't really deal with the real heart of the problem. That's one of the things that Paul said in the section that we just looked at last time. Okay, so you stop eating this stuff, and you stop drinking this stuff, and you don't work on these days, and you do all of that kind of stuff. Have you really dealt with the problem of the flesh? Have you really confronted the issue of your own worldliness, your own sin, selfishness, your lack of love for God, your lack of love for your neighbor? Has that really dealt with the problem? No, it hasn't. And it is embracing a shadow and turning away from the reality, he said. The rituals of religion are meant to point to certain realities. God has used rituals in his religious practices along the way. The Jews had dietary regulations and so on. But those weren't the point. They weren't the focus of life. They were little pointers that were meant to point to something else. And Paul's saying, now the real thing is here. The gospel is the announcement of the real thing. And the announcement of the gospel changes my relationship to the world. If I come to understand what's true, then my life in this world is not what it used to be. And so Paul has been trying, on the other hand, he's been arguing against this worldly model of religion on one side, but on the other hand, he's been building up this picture of the alternative, the gospel, the story about the cross. And part of what he's been emphasizing is the idea that the cross is central because at the cross, the problem of my alienation from God has been dealt with. I can fast and stop eating this and keep these days, and I can do it every day of my life, and if I lived forever, I could do it every day of my life forever throughout eternity, and it still doesn't reconcile me to God because I'm a miserable sinner and I stand condemned. That's a reality. what Christ did on the cross, offering himself, taking away my guilt, eradicating the charges against me, Paul talks about. That's real. That's something substantial. I have been reconciled to God. That's what I needed. That's the real deal. And now that I'm reconciled, it opens up the possibility for life. Now things have changed. I have a relationship with God, which means He's at work on me now. I am learning. I am gaining wisdom. I am growing in faith. He is my teacher. He is having an impact on my life and the way I look at things now. And He is bringing me into new life. He is going to establish His kingdom and ultimately save me from everything in this world. So because I have been reconciled, I have a new relationship with God now, which is remaking my mind, and I have the hope that I'm going to enter into a great inheritance. That's the reality. That's what Christianity is. From Paul's perspective, that's what this story is all about. God has accepted me now. Because of what Christ did on the cross, and because He's accepted me, now He is at work doing good things for me, and He is leading me to the ultimate fulfillment of my life. He used the language about my life being hidden with Christ. When Christ is revealed, then I will be revealed. And there's a sense in which, as we saw, that my life now is, it's like I'm in the waiting room. It's like the real play hasn't started yet. I'm out in the lobby, milling around, waiting for the real thing to happen. It's not that nothing's happening here in the lobby. There are people here, and, you know, sometimes I jostle into somebody, and I got to apologize to them, and I got to help them pick up their popcorn. And, I mean, you know, there's a lot to do in the lobby, but this is the lobby. The curtain hasn't gone up on Act One yet, in a sense. And when Jesus returns, that's when Act One begins. That's the perspective that the gospel gives me on this world in which I'm living. My relationship to the things of this world has changed. I don't see this as the main act anymore. I understand that I'm in the lobby. I understand that God's values are different than the values that I used to have. I used to think that life was all about getting what I can in this world. But I'm learning that's not true. That stuff's going to fail me. I can grab up everything this world has to offer and it's all going to dissolve, and then where will I be? I understand that I was under the wrath of God because of my selfishness and sin, and that this great thing has happened in what Jesus did on the cross. I understand that I have been rescued from my guilt and that He is rescuing me from my sin. Real life is to be found when sin has been eradicated. All of this is new to me. All of this is giving me a new perspective. Paul uses the language of dying with Christ. I have identified myself with His death on the cross. I see His death as central in my reconciliation to God. And now I have new life. He died, and I died with Him. He is living. I'm living with Him. Not in any mystical sense that my real soul is currently in heaven and this is just a shell walking around. I don't think he means anything like that. But his picture is, look, I'm not really a part of this world anymore. I was tied to this world because I was cut off from God and I was a sinful member of this perverse generation. But I have been saved. I have been forgiven. And I'm being rescued from it. I don't really belong here anymore. So I'm living with Him. Now, having said all of that, we're ready to look at this passage that we want to talk about today. Because what Paul is about to do is essentially to build on this picture of my death to this world and my life with Christ. Say, okay, that's the truth. The reality is, if I'm a believer, His death has become what my life is about. I've died with Him. I have been reconciled to God because of what He did on the cross. and now my life is this new thing. That being the case, then, what sort of relationship should I have with the things of this world? That's what he's about to talk about. That ritual, don't eat this, don't drink this kind of religion, that doesn't give you any real perspective on what your values ought to be. It's too focused on this world. It has forgotten where you're headed and what the purpose of this life is about. But now, if you get it, if you see, in fact, what your situation is, forgiven, destined for a place in the kingdom of God, if you see sin for what it is and life for what it is, then these are the things you will embrace. So what does he say? Therefore, put to death the earthly members, the members of the earth, literally it says, immorality, impurity, lust, evil desire, and greed, which is idolatry. New American Standard translates this, consider the members of your earthly body as dead. More simply, what it says is, put to death your earthly members. Now, the idea here, as I understand it, as we've been saying, the implications of the gospel are that I have a new relationship to the things of this world. And we're going to see, there's all sorts of reasons why that's true. I understand that my real home is in the kingdom of God. I understand that God's wrath is coming upon this world because of its sin. That sin is not my friend, it is my enemy. That holding fast rebelliously to the things of this world and saying, this is what I really need for life, that's to turn away from the truth. That's to fly in the face of what God is all about. So the more I come to see my real situation, I can see the implications of the gospel are that this stuff in this world is not really what life is all about. That's what the implications are. So Paul is saying, in essence, follow that through. Be willing to start seeing the implications of what you believe. Put to death your earthly members, he's saying. I mean, you've died with Christ. Your real life is with him. So kill this stuff off. Now, what is this stuff? What is he getting at? Well, we can see he has a number of things, but the first list that he gives, immorality, impurity, lust, evil desire, and greed, which is idolatry. His first list concentrates on the place of desire in human life today, the place of desire in the life of a believer. The first part of the list has to do with sexual immorality. Most of the, I think basically all of them in the list except the last one, do. Now, what is the deal with sexuality? Why does the Bible make such a big deal about it? We want to be really clear, I think. It's important that we be clear. I think the church in the past at times has been very unclear. And there are those who have taught in the past that sexuality itself is an evil, that to live an asexual life is the highest life, the purest life. I don't think that's a biblical teaching at all. That's not the idea. God created sexuality. He created us for marriage. It is intended to be a good thing. So what's the deal? Well, part of the reason that the Bible emphasizes sexuality a lot is because it is a powerful motivating force in human experience. Desire of all kinds, sexual desire, desire for anything in this life is not in and of itself bad. Desire is a part of what it means to be human. And the Bible doesn't look down on desire. It doesn't look down on the fulfillment of my human desires. But the Bible gives me a hierarchy of values. And in the biblical hierarchy of values, it's much more valuable, much more important to be obedient to God, to submit to the truth, to know what is true and to follow it, And what that means is that desires have to find their place. There are times when the fulfillment of my desires as a human being are right and appropriate, and there are times when they are not. Sexuality is something, and we're not going to go into a whole theory of sexuality this morning, but the fact is, if we were to stop and look at it and think about it, we would see that sexuality is intended by God for a certain, to have a certain place in human life. It's intended to be in marriage. It's intended to have something to do with the raising of children. It's intended to be a way of communicating between a man and a woman, a communication of commitment and intimacy, of drawing together two lives coming together in one. All of that is a part of what it's supposed to be about, which means, therefore, that if I take, for instance, my sexuality and I use it in situations where, say, with people that I'm not married to, I'm lying. I'm using something that is intended to communicate the commitment of my life to someone, and in fact, I'm not making that commitment. Just yesterday on the oldies station, I heard Carol King singing, "Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?" And that's what that song was about, basically. You know, tonight the light of love is in your eyes, but will you still love me tomorrow? Yeah, you say you love me now, of course. It sure feels like love. We sure are close and intimate and lovey-dovey and everything here. But if tomorrow you go someplace else, then tonight you were lying to me. Well, lying is one of the fundamental sins. Taking the truth and perverting it so that I can have my desire, that is a profound rebellion against God. So, there's a place. When I come to see that God exists, that He has called me out of this world to believe the truth and enter into a life of righteousness, then I start to understand that my desires have to be spoken back to. I can't just follow them wherever they go. I'm not an animal, just a part of this natural creation. I don't just follow my desires where they go. I have a destiny now. I know where I'm headed, and in the kingdom of God, every desire will find its fulfillment, but will also find its right place. Every desire will submit to the truth. That's what perfection is going to look like. That's what paradise is going to be like. I will be a person who will find deep fulfillment, and at the same time, I will be in control of myself. That's great. I mean, this is part of what I really need as a human being. Well, if that's where life is headed, if that's part of what my life hidden with Christ is all about, if that's what it's going to be for me when things finally come together, then I can't anymore just live in this world as if I'm just an animal and go and submit to whatever desires I have. Every time I do that, in a sense, I'm saying the gospel isn't true. Now, am I saying that we all perfectly obey all this stuff? Absolutely not. If I were to disqualify you here on the basis of imperfect obedience to the kinds of commands that Paul is giving here, I would be disqualifying myself first of all. I mean, I'm not here to say, you know, the super spiritual person, the one who's going to heaven, is the one who's got it all together like me. I'm just not saying that. But it's at this place where we bump into the implications of the gospel for how we live. Remember who Paul's writing to. I think that he's writing to a group of people who are listening to teachers who have emphasized asceticism, don't eat this, don't drink this, and yet fundamentally they are immoral people. They have replaced a real concern with the values of the kingdom of God with a superficial religiosity. He's calling us to forget the superficial religiosity and embrace the deep implications of the gospel. The last one in his list is greed, which is similar. It fits the list pretty well. Again, we're talking about desire, but now we're not talking about sexual desire. We're talking about the desire for things in this world. The desire for the things that give security, the things that give status, the things that give pleasure, the things that seem so important. And you have got to know what I'm talking about. I mean, you cannot live in the culture of the United States in the 20th century and not be afflicted with the problem of materialism. Every one of us in here is. If you think you're not, I don't believe you. Every one of us wrestles with that problem. Every one of us is tempted to think that stuff gives life. I am tempted to think that. I think that over my years as a believer, I am starting to get it, that it does not. But have I arrived? No. But it is a lesson that I feel like at least I am willing to learn. And that's what Paul wants. He wants us to put this stuff to death. To stop thinking of myself as someone who lives on this earth in the sense that this is where existence centers. This is where life is to be found. This is not where my life is to be found. My life is to be found with Christ in His kingdom. And if that's the case, then ultimately what I need to see is true is I could lose all of this stuff and I haven't really lost anything of significance if I hold on to my inheritance in the kingdom. That's what Paul thinks. There's no question, but that's what Paul thinks. Whether we like it or not, that's what he thinks. It's interesting that he calls greed idolatry. And I think we could learn a lot just thinking about that. Because what was idolatry? When you go back and look at the history of Israel and their long battle with idolatry, idolatry is not just a religious mistake. And we need to be careful about that. It's not just, oh, when I go to the temple, I make an offering and I offer it to Baal or Moloch. And you go, oh, nope, see, wrong name. That's the wrong religion. The good people have the right religion. You're supposed to say Yahweh. Say Yahweh, Yahweh. Okay, now you have the right religion and you're okay. That's not the heart of it. What God was trying to get across to Israel is, look, there is only one God and I'm it. I am the creator. I am the sustainer of life. I am the only game in town. And the temptation of idolatry is to say, yeah, but there's some other things in this world that you don't want to mess with. I'm living in Canaanite country now here, and, you know, Baal, you get him mad at you, and, you know, the rain might not come, and it could be tough. So look, I'm going to the temple. I'm sacrificing to Yahweh. I'm doing all that stuff. But, you know, every now and again, I slip Baal a little something on the side because I don't want him to get mad at me. I mean, in essence, that's the kind of thing that idolatry was. It's denying that central reality that there is only one God. He is the only one with which we have to do. I can negotiate with all the other gods of this world, but their deals always fall through. In the end, they're going to disappear and I'm going to be stuck face to face with God. And I'm going to hold my contract up and say, see, I have a deal with Baal. He takes care of me. He said, no, unfortunately, he has no jurisdiction here. And nobody does. Bill Gates doesn't have any jurisdiction there. Nobody with money or prestige or power in this world. Whatever they can give me, I can go to Microsoft and get a great job and get stock options and have influence and prestige and money and send my kids to exotic schools and have a yacht and I can do all that stuff. And there are people who do it. Is that stuff going to get me anywhere? No, it's not going to get me anywhere. In the end, it's all going to disappear and I'm going to be stuck facing God again. All roads lead to God. Now, we have fought that kind of notion in the sense that when people say all religions lead to God and, you know, whatever you happen to believe, you know, that this will bring you to God and he'll bless you. That's not true at all. But it is absolutely true that all roads lead to God. No matter which road you try to take, God's over there and I'll get on this one and I'll go this way. You won't notice it, but it's going to bring you right back there, and sooner or later you're going to be face to face with him, and he will have to deal with you. You will have to deal with him. No choice. It's going to happen. That's what the Bible keeps saying. The day is coming. So what are you going to do? So, idolatry then, is that idea that some god, or the way Paul is expanding it here, some thing in this world, some person, some wealthy thing, whatever, that I need that to complete the package. I have to have that to make my life ultimately a blessing. Now again, is there anything wrong with desire? No. Is it wrong to want to have food and shelter? No. Is it wrong to want to have nice things? I don't think so. God made us to appreciate beauty. I don't think I'm supposed to go around sneering at the exotic things that artisans have made in this world. You know, look at a very expensive something that somebody has made, invested hours and skill, and it's beautiful, and it costs a lot because a lot was put into it. I'm not supposed to look at that and sneer at it and say, oh, it's just part of this world and it's terrible and anybody who would appreciate that is scum. That's not the idea. Of course I should appreciate it. It's beautiful. But what am I going to do about it? If I have the opportunity to have it and I can do it in a way that I am not in conflict with some greater good that I have been called to, I think that's fine. That's not the point. Paul talks to people that he refers to as rich in some of his letters, and he doesn't tell them, you're evil for having wealth, so get rid of it all and become poor. He doesn't. What he says is, hold tight to the gospel. Be generous with your money. Remember as you're using your money what the true values are. That's what he says. So, what we're being warned against is that kind of idolatry, that kind of belief that something other than God is essential. That's what greed ultimately is, he's saying. If I have that sense that I've got to have this, then I don't understand. Because there isn't anything I've got to have except what God has promised in the gospel. If I hold tight to the gospel, then conversely, I'm holding loosely to the things of this world. Paul said, you remember, that he had learned to be content in whatever circumstance. He had learned to go without, and he had also learned to deal with abundance. He had also learned how to deal with those times in his life when he had a lot. He could be content then too. Grateful for what he had, but holding it loosely enough that if something more important came along, he could let it go. That's what we're shooting for. That's what it means to put to death my earthly members. It's to see my life in this world as a journey to my real life. And if that's the case, then I pick things up and I put things down along the journey, whatever it takes to make the journey. If I'm in the wilderness wandering toward the promised land, I'm a fool to set up and build a huge permanent structure and say, hey, I think I like it here, I'll stay. You're stuck in the wilderness forever. We're going someplace. And so you pack light. That's in essence what Paul is getting across here. So, now we haven't gone very far. I didn't think we would here. But what he's starting to do, what the issue is here for him. The religion that he has been fighting, this religious ascetic sort of thing, is from his perspective worldly. It is rooted in this world. It's impressed with itself for eating certain ways, but it hasn't really dealt with the fundamental issue. Is my life to be found in this world or not? It is when I understand the gospel, I see that I need to be reconciled to God and that I have a new life with God. It is then that my life in this world takes on perspective. It's not that I stop living here, but I see where I am in the light of the way things really are. That's what we're called to. That's what I understand. I mean, go letter after letter from Paul. What is he trying to get across to them? Basically, he's trying to get across that. Okay, you guys believed this. I showed up. I preached. You said, yay, Jesus is the Messiah. Sounds great. But now you guys are facing that same question in the real world. You're facing that question as you bump into these teachers over here. Or you're facing that question as you bump into your own, you're being persecuted and you're poor and you don't have everything that you want in this world. Now ask the question, what does Jesus mean to you? Now something's on the line, something's at stake, and you're confronting the question about the truth of the gospel in a new and profound way. That's what he's saying to them here. Hang on to the gospel that you believed at first. Now that you start to see what some of the issues are, now that you start to see that there's this choice over here that looks kind of attractive, now's the time to say, yeah, but the problem is that's a lie, and this is the truth, and hold fast to it. And that means then starting to see through, starting to see my desires of all sorts in their proper place, to see them in relationship to the big picture. Where is life to be found? That's the question that we face over and over again. Where is my good to be found? You know. I know it's true. I know it's true in my life. I'm absolutely convinced it's true in every life, the life of every person here, that you are very interested, are preoccupied with the question, where is my good to be found? You are interested in your own welfare. You are looking for that which will fulfill. Paul is interested in that too. He's just saying, you know, the problem is you have bought a lie from this world if you think that anything here is ultimately going to be able to fulfill you. Hold to it loosely, use it for what it is, enjoy it for what it can bring, set it aside when something more important comes along, and then it will give you what it can. And meanwhile, you will find your true fulfillment in the things which God has come to bring. But if you try to make them your fulfillment, they won't work, and in the end, you have nothing in your hands. Okay, well, I'll stop there and give you a few minutes to ask questions, make comments.
The analogy of the theater lobby was kept me preoccupied as you were. And I wanted to maybe use it, and you let me know when it breaks down. But if we're people in the lobby, I see the church in the lobby, the people that want to follow God and get there behind the curtain, flocking or attracted to how much magic can come into the lobby from behind the curtain before the curtain's raised. I wanted to find out from you how iron is that curtain. I think the more brilliance and a lot of people call it experience they can have from God magic in the lobby from behind the curtain is where look at the networks, you know, you can look at the airwaves for the numbers that kind of magic produces.
Right. Yeah, well, I'm right with you there. Those numbers certainly are out there. That's a very attractive message these days. I want to be careful. I'm not denying the reality of God's work in this world. I mean, it's not an iron curtain in the sense that God is on the other side of it and nothing's happening now until we get there. That's not what I mean. But What I'm saying is that when we read Paul's letters, what we see him being preoccupied with is God's work now being the promotion of knowledge about him, perspective about life. What we saw in Colossians, it started out with this long prayer about God imparting to them knowledge of him, changing their life so that they would walk in such a way as their understanding of the gospel would have an impact on the way they live. That's where the magic is happening, from my perspective. That's the guaranteed magic in this life, that there is a group of people who are slowly waking up from their blindness and starting to see the truth. And in that, their lives, the lemmings are all marching off over the cliff, and yet there are those who have turned around and they're walking the other way. So in that sense, there's a lot happening here. But I do think that the church, some parts of the church today, have been sold a bill of goods. They've been told that God's preoccupation in this life is to make sure that I have as much experience of God now as I can, as much financial reward, as much health, as much spiritual power and dynamic living and all of that. That's what the gospel's about. Silent. From my perspective, the book is silent about that.
Would you consider that the elemental things of the world as well? The signs and wonders on this side of the curtain. That's sort of what I was thinking about. You let me know if the analogy is starting to break down.
Well, I don't think that's what Paul meant when he talked about the elemental things, the elementary things. I think to him it was the elementary religious things like fastings and rituals and that kind of thing. That's the kindergarten stuff. That's the shadow that points to another reality. But there's a sense in which I think we could say the same thing about the flashily miraculous in this world. God did that too, but he did that for a purpose as well. Here's a great example, I think. Jesus fed the 5,000. Did he go on every day from then on passing out bread supernaturally to everyone? No. As far as we know, he did that twice. But what happened the next day after he fed the 5,000? This huge crowd came and followed him, and what he said to them is, you came because of the bread. You saw me pass out the bread, and you ate it, and were filled, and you want some more. Well, but that's not why I did it. I didn't give you the bread to teach you man lives by bread alone, so come and get some from Jesus as much as you can. I did it to remind you that man does not live by bread alone, that this is a sign. I am the one from God. And now that you've seen me miraculously do the bread, and you ask yourself the question, who is this guy? And maybe you come to the conclusion, as you should, that this is the Messiah sent from God. Now come to me and ask me, what are you here for? What did you come to bring? And I'll tell you what I came to bring. I came to bring eternal life. And that's what he goes on to say. So that's a real great example of a very flashy, miraculous thing that had its purpose, but it was not meant to be the point. And I really do think, as you were saying, that we have mistakenly gotten the idea that the dynamic, the miraculous, the zippy kind of stuff, that's the point. That's what God came to bring us. That's not what Paul's saying. Why is this such good news? Why should you not abandon the gospel? Because in the gospel you find reconciliation with God. And when you're reconciled with God, you are his child, and he teaches you wisdom, and he brings you into eternal life. That's it. That's the package that Paul describes. And you go someplace else, and that's the same package. He just keeps describing that package over and over again. So, yeah, I don't mind your taking the analogy further. I mean, all analogies break down, and I'm sure we could make mine break down really fast if we wanted to. But
I was struck by something when you talked about the passage saying, kill your earthly members, mm-hmm. and meaning repudiate, mm-hmm. All the stuff that you used to be about and be about what Jesus is about now. Because when I was a fairly young Christian, maybe 2 or 3 years old in the Lord, I had this funny dream that was really disturbing. Before I tell you what happened, I should say that, like probably everybody else, the idea of hurting anybody, especially hurting them seriously, is horrifying. When I was in school, I did some volunteer work at Mission Emergency Hospital in San Francisco, included doing CPR on people in the emergency room, and very often, usually they were older folks, and when you do CPR on older folks, their ribs will crack. And the first time I did CPR, and I heard the crack of the ribs, I was just totally, and the doctor looked at me, and just without, he knew what I was thinking, and I must have had this look on my face like, oh my God, mm-hmm. what did I do? And he looks at me and goes, don't stop. A broken rib is nothing compared to a stopped heart. Keep going. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to emphasize that I have the same reactions as everybody else. If I thought that I accidentally killed somebody, you know, hit something and then discovered it was a person and they were dead, it would just be totally traumatic. So when I had this dream, it was very strange. And what I dreamt was, as the dream opens up, sort of you can imagine the screen, light coming up on the screen, I'm hiding behind a door with some knitting needles in my hand. And a woman comes down the hallway, walks in the door, and I leap on her, knock her to the ground, and start plunging my knitting needles into her chest. She's not really struggling. She's just begging me not to do this. And at the time I'm doing this, I'm thinking, I'm sorry that I have to do this, but I have to do this. And when I woke up, I wasn't horrified at the idea that I had just killed a person in my dream. I was horrified that I wasn't horrified. That not only in my dream did I have this sense of, I'm sorry that this is hurting you, but this has to be done. But even when I woke up and contemplated it, I was not horrified. And that it was my horror at my lack of horror that when I started thinking about the dream and kind of replaying it, I realized this woman, she was dressed sort of like a counterculture type. She had leotards and tights on and love beads and long hair. And when I looked at her a little bit more, I realized that she was me. And I finally decided that sometimes my dreams have the effect of sort of letting me know what's going on with me when I don't realize it in any other way. But I think what happened was, I was killing off the old me, the part of the rebellious part of me, the part of me that said, you know, if it feels good, do it, and that kind of thing. So obviously it's been, 18 years or something since I had that dream, but it's just crystal clear in my brain. And when you said that, I just thought it was really, it's a perfect picture of what was happening in the dream.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. And it's right, I think. I mean, we haven't gotten to talking about the old man and new man stuff. We'll get that next time, I hope. But what he's getting at here, I think, as I was alluding to at the beginning, is it's not some sort of a mystical, I need to tap into the power of this new person that's been stuck inside me or something like that, but it is this choice he's confronting us with between what we were in this world, our values, our beliefs, our lostness, that whole package, turning away from that and embracing this new thing that God is doing. We are this new creation if in fact we belong to God, if in fact we have embraced the gospel. But it involves, even as we are this new creation, that plays itself out in our choice to embrace the new and turn away from the old. That's the thing, the tension in this letter and in a lot of the letters. On the one hand, he's praying to God that he would do this thing for them and that this is a work of God, a thing that God is doing, and yet it plays itself out in our struggle to make that choice, to look and say, no, this is a lie and this is the truth. And from now on, the letter is about that struggle. It's confronting us with that question. Am I gonna buy into this or not? And we'll see more of that as we go along. We've kind of run out of time. Hopefully we'll get to the old man, new man stuff next time, I think. So we'll see you next time.